This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, it's Gary Clinton here, and believe it or not, this is the 121st episode of Night Transmissions. We're going to start off here with an episode of Crime Classics, a show of which I am actually quite fond. This episode, which aired on January the 20th of 1954, it's entitled Madeline Smith, Maid of Murderers. This series was extremely well written, with a good tongue-in-cheek attitude throughout. An attitude made perhaps slightly more remarkable by the fact that the subjects of each of these series is murder. Today's, for example, it involves a randy, somewhat dandy Frenchman with a French accent that is about as sincere as an American actor could possibly be. There's a landlady, very helpful landlady, Madeline Smith herself, and, there's this case of the nasties. And a very slow learner. This story, by the way, is well based on an actual event, the trial for murder in Glasgow, Scotland, of Madeline Smith. My brief research on the case, mostly limited to an article in Wikipedia, did happen pretty much as described by the show. Sit back and enjoy. I think you'll have a smile or two. Maybe a chill or two, but more smiles than chills. By the way, I'll put up a link to the Wikipedia article on the webpage to make it easier for you to check it out.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland with another true story of crime. Listen. That's the way the doorbell sounded at number 14 Pembroke Street in Glasgow, Scotland. That's the way it sounded if a fellow was impatient. If he had just come home from Madeline Smith's house on a March day in 1857 and really wanted in. His name was Pierre-Émile Langelier, and the door was in his way. Why didn't someone answer anyway? Here comes his landlady. She gasped because Pierre was her favorite lodger, and he looked terrible. Awful, standing there in the doorway, swaying, before he fell on his face. Dead. Tonight, my report to you on Madeline Smith, maid or murderess, which?
Crime Classics. A series of true crime stories from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Mr. Thomas Highland.
Even in the middle 1800s, Kelvin Grove Park was a place to be reckoned with in Glasgow, in the springtime particularly. A bonny place, a place of greens and merry shouts, where gambled the bekilted young people, or the more serious ones where they strolled hand in hand toward some magical and shady and secret glen. In a street which paralleled the park, Pembroke Street, there was a red brick house. It was owned by Mary Perry, a woman of 50, who liked imaginative men, young men of elegance and foreign flavor, like her lodger, Pierre-Émile Langelier.
In all my travels the world over, my dear Mademoiselle Perry, I have never seen such a girl. Once in Algiers, perhaps. But that is another story. Temps perdu, temps perdu.
For the last week, you've done nothing but talk about this young lady, Pierre. Oh. Where did you see her today?
Auprès de la docks, where the pond for them is, throwing to them little pieces of bread, and some, more brave than the rest, would swim close to her, and she would make small noises to them, and feed them from her hand. And what else, mademoiselle, you will never guess?
Oh, tell me.
Her name is Madeleine. Madeleine Smith.
Oh, how do you know?
This morning, there was a maidservant with her, and they became separated for a moment, and I approached the maidservant.
With that way you have, I'll wager. That thing you do with your moustache.
Well, yes.
Yeah, do it for me.
No, mademoiselle.
Ah, please.
No, mademoiselle.
Oh, s'il vous plaît.
Very well. enough.
And from the maidservant you learned the lady's name.
Yes, and what her father's name is and where she lives.
Oh.
Her father is Monsieur Smith, the architect, a man of wealth and position. I spent the rest of the morning trying to locate his bank.
And did you?
Certainement. He is very wealthy, which makes Madeleine a beautiful young woman with a wealthy father.
Ah, I'm happy for you, Pierre.
Oh, but alas, Madeleine is still to me a stranger.
But you know so well how to...
No, this is a young lady of refinement. I love her very much. If I should do this thing you like me to do and she would laugh at me, I would jump into the duck pond and drown myself forever.
Then how would you meet her?
Will you help me, chère mademoiselle? Will you help me?
Greedy, greedy, greedy. Oh, very well. Here's one for you.
Here now.
Here's some bread. Here you are, you lovelies. Bread for you and you and you. Isn't it a lovely day?
I beg your pardon?
I said, isn't it a lovely day?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
The ducks seem so frisky today, don't they?
Except Abby. See how she sulks there.
Here, Abby. Here. Oh, sulky duck. Young miss.
Yes?
You come here every day, don't you?
Why, yes.
I watch you from my window from across the street.
Why, whatever for?
Oh, such a young thing, and beautiful you are, which is such a joy to an old lady such as I. To an...
What's the matter?
I have a pain. Oh, dear.
Where?
The nasties. They come on me. I think I'll faint.
Oh, my. I'll help you over to the bench. And here, put your arm about my waist and careful now.
Dear ladies, may I be of some assistance?
I have here a home medical advisor of the era. The nasties, also known as the vapors, a sudden attack of malaise, predominantly in the female sex, usually preceding a faint. Symptoms, loud noises in the ears, quickening of the heartbeat, and dizziness. Make patient comfortable and apply smelling salts.
Now, lie down here on the bench, madame, and we will try to make you comfortable. Now, if there were smelling salts...
I have smelling salts.
Oh, how beautiful of you.
What?
Quickly, the smelling salts.
And that's the way they met. Mary Perry inhaling the smelling salts, and the two young folk looking at her, concerned. Then the two young folk looked at each other, and became more concerned, and trembled a bit. And the symptoms they felt were quickening of the heartbeat, dizziness, and loud noises in the ears. And they did what young folks most always did when they are met in Kelvin Grove Park. Somehow their fingertips met and their hands, and they strolled and they found a shady glen. Miss Perry watched them disappear with a happy tear in her eye. She had done her bit for Pierre. Things went so well between the two young people that a couple of weeks later, this was the state of affairs.
Your mama and papa?
Asleep. Oh. Quickly. Come on in. Careful. Careful. Every time you come through this window...
Then why do you not put the lamp in another place?
Shh. Oh, Mimi. Oh, my darling. Shady. Love.
Mimi, Mimi, Mimi.
Oh, we will marry.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, Mimi.
Right way.
Then you've talked to your mama and your papa.
Yes.
And they are happy. They are overjoyed.
No.
But you said...
We can still get married. You have a job and I'll work and...
You? Work?
What's the matter?
The thought of you at work, stitching and sewing, or at the laundry, with these fingers, these precious little fingers.
Oh, Pierre.
In other words, your mama and your papa...
will disinherit me if I marry you.
I refuse to have you disinherited.
But then we won't get married?
No, somehow...
What?
It is more romantic this way. Letters to each other each day. And the clandestine meeting. And the kisses. And the...
I know. The hot chocolate.
Oh, yes.
It should be boiling now. I bring it to you.
And that was the romance.
My own beloved, you have just left me. Oh, sweet darling, at this moment my heart and soul burns with love for thee, my own sweet one. Oh, what would I not give at this moment to be your fond wife? I love you with all my heart and soul, sweet love.
To which her lover answered,
my dearest beloved Mimi, since I saw you, I have been wretchedly sad. Think of the consequences if I were never to marry you. What reproaches I should have, Mimi. However, as soon as your papa pledges not to disinherit you, there will be a wedding the likes of which...
And the meetings.
Oh, pass it down.
And the nourishment.
Ah, oh, Mimi, the hot chocolate of my Mimi is...
Oh, Pierre.
Oh, my darling.
No, listen.
Yes?
We have been meeting like this for 6 months now.
6 months of paradise and bliss and...
When will we marry?
Has your father changed his mind?
Today my father introduced me to a young man.
Oh, who will quickly fall in love with you and die in despair for your love. Oh, Mimi.
Wait.
Mimi. Why?
His name is William Minnick, and he is handsome and he is rich.
And?
Oh, Pierre, I do wish we could get married.
That's the way it's done, Miss Smith. Manipulation. Borrow from one stock to buy the other, and when the other has gone up, then we pay back. You see?
And that is how one becomes rich, Mr. Minnick? Well, is it?
Oh, I suppose so. Oh, Miss Smith.
Careful, careful, you'll fall. Perhaps you'd just better row, Mr. Minnick.
All right. Miss Smith?
Yes, William?
You said William.
Yes, I did.
And may I call you...
Madeline.
Madeline. Madeline.
Yes.
It's 2 months since I've known you.
Yes.
Last night I spoke to your father.
About me.
How dear you are to me. How much I love you.
And what did my father say to you?
That if you'll have me, he would be very happy. Oh, Madeline.
Oh, I don't know. I just don't know.
But you must. These wonderful days together, you've given me hope.
Oh, William.
Aye.
Put the oars down. Now, come here. Kiss me, William. Why, William, that was very nice, William. Very nice indeed.
Madeline. Madeline. Oh, Madeline. Madeline.
Better and better gets your hot chocolate, chérie.
My sweetheart, my love.
There is something I must ask you, Pierre.
Yes.
My letters.
I have saved every one.
I want them back.
But why, my pigeon?
Well, I think sometimes of what I've written to you. And such outpourings.
But your outpourings are for my eyes alone.
Oh, give them back to me.
No.
But why not?
I will tell you why not, little dove. If you look with love at another man, I will take the letters to your father and prove to him that your love for this another man is a passing thing, and that your love is only for me, your true love, who you will marry as soon as your father puts aside a suitable dowry for you.
I see.
Of course you do.
You are blackmailing me, Pierre.
Oh, love, love, come to me. Kiss me, kiss me. How cool your lips are, love.
Apothecary. I would like 5 ounces of arsenic.
A few words about arsenic. Its number on the Mendeleev table is 33. Its atomic weight is 74.93, and it has a valence of 3 and 5. It is of a silvery luster, but be careful about exposing it to the air, since it will tarnish readily. It is used widely in glassworks, in making pigments, in calico and indigo printing, and for poisoning animals. Some people eat it. In the Balkans in particular, it is possible to brush shoulders with arsenic eaters. Other people, however, less innocent, use arsenic to poison people. Still other people use arsenic to poison themselves. I would like to remind you that Madeline Smith, a beauty of Glasgow, Scotland, purchased 5 ounces of the stuff from McConnert, the apothecary. But then arsenic was also used for the skin as a clarifying agent, it is said. Madeline purchased it, went home, had dinner, chatted with her folks, waited for them to sleep, put some hot chocolate to a boil, returned to her room, waited a bit, and opened the window.
Oh, chérie, chérie. Oh,
my darling.
Yeah. Vraiment?
What?
Truly?
Why, of course you are my darling.
Then what about Monsieur Minor? What endearment did you name him? Guppy? Sweet bun? What? Lovey? Honey pie? Ginger snap? What? I have seen you.
Spy.
Because only I am a man in love. Therefore, I am capable of every ruse. What is spying to a man in love?
If you loved me, you'd give me back my letters.
Oh, letters, letters.
Oh, my darling, give them back to me.
If I did, how would I keep my heart warm when you are not near to it? How would I...
Oh, stop it, stop it.
Of course. Now, come to me.
No. Pierre.
Yes?
You are cruel.
Cruel and gentle, sane and mad, the prerogatives of a man in love.
Yet you would show those letters to my father.
To your father, to your mother, to the man on the street, anything to keep you from another.
Pierre.
Yes, little pigeon.
You say that you've seen me with Mr. Minnock. How?
I was behind a bush in the park, near the glen that we used to know.
And?
I heard Monsieur Minnock ask over and over that you set a marriage date. I heard also you were laughing, but I did not hear you saying no.
My father said I might marry him, Pierre.
Then tell your papa you do not wish it. Oh, Madeleine.
Yes.
This morning, I read again your letters. Such letters, such warmth, such eagerness, such ardor, such... Is there chocolate, Mimi?
Oh, always. I'll fetch it.
Oh, little pigeon.
You're happy.
Oh.
Your Madeleine was,
And you?
Me?
The most perfect landlady in the whole world.
Pierre!
Help me. Help me.
What's the matter? You have the nasties. You have...
Miss Perry knelt over Pierre, and she knew right away it wasn't the nasties. His eyes were rolling around, and his mouth was grimacing in wordless pain. She went for the cologne, dabbed a little on herself, came back, dabbed a little bit on her lodger. A little later, she helped him up the stairs.
Lean on me, Pierre, lean on me.
And helped him to his bed. Miss Perry was never so efficient as when there was a helpless man about. The next morning, Pierre was completely recovered. The next night, he went to visit Madeleine in her chambers again. Refused to give up the letters again, and had some of that good hot chocolate again. Came home to Miss Perry and fell flat on his face again. This time he was in bed for 3 days. Which brings us to the evening of March 23rd. As he was walking toward his sweetheart's house, Madeleine Smith was attending Mr. Minnock.
Oh, come sit by me, William.
Hmm?
Sit here by me. I wish to talk with you.
Okay.
Oh, dear William, do you love me very much, William?
Oh, hi.
How much?
From here to a star, Father.
Suppose, William...
Hush, hush, hush.
Oh, but you must listen.
No, you listen to me. If you're about to tell me about that monsieur, about Pierre Langelier, don't. I have heard whispers. But I deny them with a laugh and a shrug in it. What's that?
The shutter, perhaps. Nothing. I'll see what it is. Oh, and William.
I love.
There's some chocolate on the kitchen table. Put it on the stove over the fire.
Of course, love.
And wait for me down there. Quickly, come in.
Oh, I have missed you, I have missed you, I have missed you.
Oh, my darling.
3 days I was in bed and my thoughts of you always, dearest Mimi.
I know your thoughts fled to me and caressed me and warmed me.
Vraiment?
Truly.
Oh, was there ever a love such as ours?
Never, never, oh, never.
And eventually...
What?
We will marry... Did you know that?
Do you truly think so?
Oh, what manner of man would I be? This tapping upon the window, this stepping over the casement to your arms. Of course we will marry someday.
Oh?
Of course. For each day, each night that I come here to you and hold you close, I bind you closer to me and there is no escape.
No escape?
None.
Pierre?
Yes.
Haven't you been feeling well?
Well, I said to you I was in bed for 3 days.
Why? From what illness?
Love all over. Twice.
Oh?
Each time I have left you, the last 2 times, I have gone to my lodging house and I have sickened.
Oh?
Madeleine, I know just the thing.
Oh?
Hot chocolate.
I'll fetch you some.
Oh, guppy.
Émile Langelier, dead. He was buried Thursday, March 26th, and on Monday, the 30th...
Look at those letters, sir. I told you she poisoned him. These letters, sir. They were in his room. I was the dear man's landlady, and I demand the police read these letters.
The police read them. On Tuesday, they dug Pierre up again, shipped him to the laboratories, and the skillful men there found 86 grains of arsenic in his body. That same day, Madeleine was arrested, charged with 2 counts of attempted murder and 1 count of murder, and brought to trial on the 30th of June. Madeleine herself did not testify, but Mr. Minoch did.
I am a merchant in Glasgow. In the course of the last months, I paid my addresses to Miss Smith, and I have made proposals of marriage to her. She accepted. I knew, of course, that she knew a man named Pierre-Émile Langelier, but I was unaware of an attachment or peculiar intimacy between she and this man. And of the letters this court has read, I...
What of the letters, Mr. Minoch?
I don't know what to say. Yes, I do. I'm shocked. I'm deeply shocked.
The trial lasted 9 days. To one charge of attempted murder, Madeleine Smith was found not guilty. To the other charge of attempted murder, the verdict brought in was not proven. To the charge of murder, the verdict, not proven.
I want to congratulate you, Madeleine, on your acquittal.
Oh, now we can be wed.
Oh, no. I'm off to India.
However, she did get married twice, and she came to America. She lived till she was 90 years old. An amazing thing, her complexion, always clear and youthful. She was a frequent sight at the drug counters, a big buyer of arsenic, wherever she was. Wilbur Hatch, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Betty Harcourt was heard as Madeleine, Lawrence Walcott as Mary, John Daner as Pierre, and William Johnstone as Minoch. Gil Warren speaking. America listens most to the CBS Radio Network.
truth is stranger than fiction. This is the truth. This is Ripley. Believe it or not.
The first air-conditioned house in the United States was Lime Air, built in Luray, Virginia by Colonel T.C. Northcott. It was kept cool in summer and warm in winter by air piped from the nearby Luray Caverns. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about a weaponless duel.
Yes, sir, life is swell when you keep well. And say what a really swell cereal Post Bran Flakes are. Crisp and crunchy. And what a wonderful nut-like flavor. And then those extra benefits. The benefits of bran so many of you may need to help you keep fit naturally. So why don't you join the millions who enjoy Post Bran Flakes every day for their delicious flavor, for their extra benefits. Yes, life is swell when you keep well.
One of the strangest duels where no weapons were used was between two sculptors. The Great Buddha, a statue in the Diamond Mountains of Korea, was carved 600 years ago by a sculptor named Kingdo. It's there because of an unusual duel in which Kingdo and a rival sculptor named Rao agreed that whichever created the poorer statue would forfeit his life. Kingdo won, and Rao drowned himself. Believe it or not.
Suspense. One of the classics of old-time radio, brought to life by William Spear, whose formula in this program was one of simple human drama set in interesting situations. Like tonight's show, The Bride Vanishes, which would originally air on December the 1st of 1942, almost exactly a year after the United States entered World War II. The program isn't too specific about exactly when the events in the program occurred. From comments at the very beginning, it's clear that it predates World War II by a little bit, and so is set in pre-war Capri, as a young American couple is on their honeymoon. Lucy, that's the name of the bride, is a little freaked out by all the attention she is garnering on the boat between Italy and Capri. Everybody is looking at her so strangely, so familiar, like they know her, like they've seen her before, and like maybe they've seen a ghost.
Suspense is compounded of mystery and intrigue and dangerous adventure. Stories calculated to intrigue you, to stir your nerves. Tonight, for instance, as we begin, you may want to ask yourself, how could a young lady, a bride, walk out on a balcony alone and vanish? Completely vanish. We trust that while you are wondering how and why it was done, we shall keep you in suspense.
For Suspense, tonight CBS presents The Bride Vanishes by John Dixon Carr.
Italy in springtime. Italy as we used to know it before the jackal struck. And the island of Capri, 20 miles out across the Bay of Naples. Blue water adazzle under the sun. Behind to the bone-white beaches and Vesuvius dull purple in a heat haze. Ahead, as the little steamer from Naples chugs out across the bay, rises Capri. Olive trees and white roads and vineyards above the cliffs. Could young Americans find a better place to spend their honeymoon? While the guitars sing and the warm winds blow, and the little steamer carries them.
Well, Mrs. Courtney?
Well, Mr. Courtney?
I can't keep it up, Lucy. I'm going to break down and ask if you're happy.
Oh, I'll break down, too. I want to walk up to everybody I meet and say, whee, just like that.
What I want to do is turn somersaults myself, all along this deck here.
I want to say, I've been married to Tom Courtney for practically 2 weeks. And now we're going to have a villa at Capri for a month. Oh, Tom, I ought to be the happiest woman in the world. Only...
You shivered. What's wrong?
Well, ever since we got aboard this ship, people have been staring at me.
I can't blame you for that, dear.
No. I mean in a funny way. And muttering. Even your American friend. What's his name?
Granger?
Mr. Granger. When you introduced him to me at Naples, I thought his eyes were going to pop out.
Be careful. He's standing over by the rail now.
Oh.
He lives at Capri.
I like to see him wearing that white 10-gallon hat in Italy.
Before Granger made money in oil wells, he was a real old-fashioned cowpuncher. And he's proud of it. Good fellow, too.
He's too polite to say anything, but he keeps looking around at me, just the same as the rest of them do.
Well?
Well, Tom, they look scared.
You know, Lucy, this isn't the time to start imagining things.
I know. Maybe I'm just so happy I'm afraid it can't last.
Oh, don't say that.
But wouldn't it be pretty awful if something did happen and we weren't together any longer?
Wait a minute. Hasn't this ship stopped?
Yes. Well, it is Capri ahead of us, isn't it?
It can't be anything else. Well, it seems a funny place to stop. No sign of a harbor. Only rocks and little gray cliffs. Oh, Mr. Granger. Mr. Granger.
Yes, young fella?
Do you happen to know why we're stopping here?
Well, yes, that's an easy one, sir. We're stopping so that you and your good lady and anybody else who's curious can get a look at the Blue Grotto.
The Blue Grotto, of course.
Now, just shave your eyes with your hand, ma'am. You see that tiny little arch under the cliff?
Yes.
And all the little white rowboats are coming out towards us?
Yes.
Now, when the first boat comes alongside, you climb down that iron ladder and get in. The boatman will row you out and through the arch into the grotto. It's a great big dark cavern. The water in there looks as though it's lit up underneath with blue fire.
Mm. Like to go out and see it, Lucy?
Oh, I'd love to.
But let me give you a little tip, though. The current's pretty fast out there. You'll go shooting under that arch like 60.
Are we likely to upset?
Oh, no, but the arch isn't as high as your head. When you see it coming, lie back flat in the boat. That is, unless you want your block knocked off.
Well, thanks, Mr. Granger. We'll remember. Come along, Lucy. Easy on the ladder, Lucy. Don't look around yet.
Oh, I'm all right, darling. And just as good a swimmer as you are.
I'm in the boat now. Take one more step. Steady. Yeah. There you are. Now turn around facing the boatman and sit down here beside me.
What's the matter with the boatman?
Easy, man. Do you want to upset us? Sit down.
You come back, yes?
Come back? Well, I've never been here before in my life.
Push off, man. Start rowing. The other boats are piling up behind you.
You come back.
Start rowing, can't you? Andare subito. Basta.
Tom, he can't take his eyes off us.
I wish he'd watch out where he's rowing.
You come to live at the Villa Borghese, yes?
Tom, how did he know that?
He's the lady. She is not dead.
Dead? Of course she's not dead. What are you talking about?
She never come to Capri before?
Never.
Then I tell you, she will disappear just like the other one.
Disappear?
I arrest my orders, and I tell you.
Tom, aren't we moving rather fast?
Yes, it's the entrance to the grotto ahead.
I tell you, there was a lady so much like your own. Caught a big back, it scared me.
Now look, old man, I don't want to teach you your business, but you've got your back to that grotto.
Take this lady back where she come from. Do not take her to the Villa Borghese.
Down, Lucy. Flat on your back. Down!
Signora, signora, I am sorry. I almost make you get hurt.
You know you nearly got your own head knocked off.
Excuse me, Nor. I am used to it. Now, I will row you round the Blue Grotto.
I don't think I like it much, Tom.
Neither do I.
Dark.
for that blue light under the water. It's transparent. You can see the fishes swimming.
Just a minute, boatman. This lady who disappeared from the Villa Borghese.
2-3 years ago, she disappeared.
You say she looked exactly like my wife?
Si, signore. She was going to be married. She was trying on a, what do you call, her wedding dress. Her mother and sisters, they were in the room with her. She walked out on a balcony over the sea. You know what I mean, on a balcony over the sea? Nobody ever hear of her again.
You mean she jumped over into the sea?
Or a young girl going to be married. Kill herself? No, 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 no.
And what did happen?
Oh, but the beggar, I do not know. But sometimes they say you can meet her ghost in here. She float just under the water where you can see her and turn over and over. And the wedding veil is still round her face.
Tom, let's get out of here.
You want to go, yes?
Lucy, if this fellow's stringing us along...
He's not stringing us along.
Then somebody ought to know what this means. If we've inherited a haunted balcony where people disappear like soap bubbles, I say it's too much. Let's get back to our ship and talk to Granger. Yes, boatman, take us back.
Ma'am. Oh. You too, young woman. This ship is stuck. Have a second. Here, give me a hand, Lucy.
Thank you. Oh, didn't anybody else go to the Blue Grotto?
Well, ma'am, no. Not after they saw you go.
It's all right. We've just heard the story, Mr. Granger.
Oh, I ought to have told you about it myself. All the way out here, I've been cussing myself and thinking what an ornery old badger I am for not telling you when I first met you in Naples.
The girl did vanish then.
By a first-rate miracle, yes. In broad daylight and within 20 feet of her mother and sisters.
You don't look like a man who'd believe in miracles, Mr. Granger.
Oh, I'm not, son. I'm just telling you what happened.
But why is everybody so excited? Somebody must have thrown her off the balcony.
Josephine Adams was all alone on a balcony 40 feet up a cliff, smooth as glass. She didn't fall, she wasn't thrown because there was no sound of a splash, and she didn't come back from the balcony because her mother and sisters were in front of the only door. Yet, within 15 seconds, mind you, she just vanished.
You believe that?
Sure, I believe it, son. It's a fact.
Did you know the girl's family?
Oh, very well. We've got a real English-speaking colony here. Oh, by the way, in about a half a minute now, I'm going to show you your new home.
Oh, can we see it here on the ship?
Oh, sure you can, ma'am. It's on the edge of the cliff. Dr. Davis's house is on one side of it, and my shack's on the other. That's why I want to ask you a question.
Of course. Ask anything you like.
Well, I'm an old stager, ma'am, and not exactly up to the high-toned society around here, but do you trust me?
Yes, I think so.
Well, then promise me something. Unless you're with somebody you do trust, keep away from that balcony.
Do you honestly think there's danger or...
I don't know, son. If I did, I wouldn't have to talk this way.
Sounds like a dog barking. I thought I heard it before.
What is a big police dog? And led by a very handsome woman, if you ask me.
Oh, Lord, here she is again.
Who?
The Countess. She lives in our colony.
She looks like an American. You take your eyes off her, Tom Courtney.
She is an American. Married a Count Farchese or something like that. Just call her Nellie.
My dear Mr. Granger.
Hello, Nellie.
It's true. Everybody told me so, but I couldn't believe it until I saw her. She does look exactly like poor Josephine Adams. Just as small, just as dainty.
Please, is everybody trying to give me the jitters?
Nellie, I want you to meet some friends of mine.
Oh, you don't need to introduce me. I know who they are. You're the nice young couple who've taken that villa. I'm Nellie LeCave.
Oh, yes.
This is my dog, Tiberius, named after the wicked Roman emperor. You know who used to live at Capri? I must confess I'm terribly fascinated by wicked things. Aren't you, Mr. Courtney?
Lucy, stop digging me in the ribs. I haven't done anything.
No, and you're not going to.
Tiberius seems to have taken quite a fancy to you, Mrs. Courtney.
Oh.
I've never known him to go to a stranger before.
Well, I only wish I could borrow him. He might be a charm against... Oh, I don't know.
We'll be at the harbor in a few minutes. Then you must let me drive you up to the villa. You won't be able to get any servants, I'm afraid, because they won't stay there. But you can camp out.
Look, there's the villa. We're passing it now.
Where?
On the cliff, where I'm pointing.
Wait a minute. Well, there must be some mistake. That's not the Villa Borghese.
It sure is, son.
That's a palace like all the other houses there. And I rented it furnished for about $25 a month.
Can't you guess why you got it so cheap, son? If you take my advice, you'll turn around and go back to Naples by the next steamer.
Harry Granger, don't be an idiot. Let's have some excitement. Let's have some excitement. Tom is beautiful.
Too infernally beautiful, if you ask me.
There's the balcony.
It's all right by daylight, son. Marble and tapestries and whatnot. But at night, when you gotta put out the lights, you start thinking what happened there.
The moon over Capri makes a deathly daylight. You could see to read on that balcony, if anyone went out there. Frosted glass doors open out on it from a big room on the ground floor. Two determinedly calm persons and a dog sit looking at each other.
Lucy, stop it.
Stop what?
Stop looking over at that balcony.
I'm sorry, darling.
Why are we sitting here anyway? There's an outer room that's much more comfortable.
It's like having a toothache. A very little toothache.
I may be dense, Angel, but I don't follow you.
You put your tongue against the tooth to see if it'll hurt. You know it will hurt, but you go on doing it just the same. That's us.
Maybe you're right.
Oh, Tom, did you ever think we'd have a lovely house like this?
Yeah, the house is all right, yes. Then they have to go and spoil everything. Our honeymoon. With this blasted Tommy rod about...
Tom, you're as jittery now as I was this afternoon. Oh, even Tiberius is jittery.
Yes, I guess I am. Easy, boy. Easy, easy.
Well, there's whiskey on the table. They call it beaky here. Get yourself a drink.
In a minute. Not just now. Lucy, there's nothing wrong with that balcony. Suppose you walked out there this minute.
I've had a horrible longing to try it. Just because I know I shouldn't.
Well, nothing could attack you. All you'd have to do would be to yell. That'd bring Mr. Granger out on his balcony like a shot. And the neighbor on the other side of us would... Well, who is on the other side, by the way?
A loony doctor.
A what?
A specialist in brain diseases. Dr. David. He's English.
It's somebody in the other room. Easy, Tiberius. Easy.
Tom, I'm afraid.
It's all right, darling. You hold Tiberius's collar while I open the door. We don't want him to fly at anybody. We're going into the other room and stay there. Ready?
Yes.
Good evening, Mr. Courtney. Good evening, Mrs. Courtney. I'm no ghost, though you appear to regard me as one. I'm merely your neighbor, Dr. Rutherford Davis.
Yes, of course. Mr. Granger mentioned you.
I trust you will pardon this intrusion. No one answered my knock, so I ventured to come in.
It's no intrusion, Dr. Davis. We're a little disorganized here, that's all.
Naturally. Mr. Courtney, I wish I could say welcome to Capri, but I have a very different message.
Well?
If you value Mrs. Courtney's life, you'll go back to Naples immediately, sir.
Not you, too.
I do not say that as a ghost hunter, sir. I say it as a medical man. May I sit down?
Oh, of course. Please do.
Oh, thank you.
We seem to be forgetting our manners. Dr. Davis, will you have a drink?
Oh, thank you. Perhaps a small whiskey?
I'll get it, darling. You sit down and talk to Dr. Davis.
You're not going back into that room alone.
Oh, I'm only going to get the drinks, Tom. I promise to be good. And Tiberius can come with me. Can't you, Tiberius?
Oh, I see you've borrowed Tiberius from the Countess Lucchese.
Yes, she was kind enough to offer him. Excuse me, I'll be back in a minute. Come on, Tiberius.
I hope this is all right, Doctor.
No, sir. It is not all right. Your wife is in very great danger.
But why? Because of that balcony?
No. Because she looks exactly like the late Josephine Adams.
I don't get it.
Mr. Courtney, did you ever hear of paranoia?
It's some kind of mental disease, isn't it?
The paranoid begins by imagining that he or she is being persecuted by someone. First, he hears things. A voice in his brain whispers, "You'll be killed. You'll be killed. You'll be killed." He hears it in the tick of a clock, in the rattle of a train, in the footsteps on the street. There are holes in the walls through which his enemy is always watching. Invisible speaking tubes bring him messages. There are pains in his joints and nightmares of attempts to poison him. His brain bursts and he kills. He kills. He kills.
Well, excuse me for speaking so strongly.
But how does this affect us?
Mr. Courtney, will you examine this sheet of paper?
What is it?
The fragment of a typewritten diary. I found it on the cliffs months ago. Don't ask me who wrote it. But I know there's a criminal lunatic on this island. He imagined that poor, inoffensive Josephine Adams was his enemy. So he killed her.
Killed her? How?
I don't know.
And what happened to the girl's body?
I'm not a detective, sir. The body was carried out to sea, perhaps, or washed along the cliffs and into the Blue Grotto to be lost. But don't you understand the danger to your wife?
You're not suggesting that
with somebody's cracked brain, your wife is Josephine Adams, created all over again.
Kill Lucy? It couldn't be done.
It was done, my friend. Listen.
It sounded like a dog howling.
Mrs. Courtney is rather a long time in getting that whiskey.
She wouldn't go near the balcony. She promised not to go out on the balcony.
People do very perverse things, my friend, when they know they shouldn't.
Lucy! Lucy!
That seems to be Tiberius out on the balcony. I can't see anything else from here.
She's gone. She's gone. She's gone.
Empty balcony, a howling dog, and a sea turned clear silver under the moon. Then, after the tumult and the shouting, there are other pictures. Don't you hear the noise of that motor launch with a half-demented young man at the wheel? Three other familiar figures are gathered around it. Don't you recognize the brunette prettiness of Nellie Lucchese? The white 10-gallon hat of Harry Granger, and the neat, pointed beard of Dr. Davis.
But what on earth is he going to do out here in this motorboat?
I'd like to know that one myself.
Listen, please, all of you.
Now, take it easy, son. We're with you.
What time is it?
Time?
Yes. What time is it?
It's 2:30 in the morning, going on for 3.
12 hours. Then the tide ought to be just where it was this afternoon.
What's the tide got to do with it?
A whole lot. Somebody set a trap and made Lucy fall off that balcony. I know it.
Oh, that's absurd.
If Lucy's been carried out to sea, there's nothing we can do about it. But if she's been carried along with the current and into the Blue Grotto...
Blue Grotto?
One moment, sir. You're not proposing to run this big launch under that arch after dark?
Yes, Doctor. That's just exactly it.
Go on. Do it. I'll back you up. Let's have some excitement.
It'll be exciting enough, I assure you. Mr. Courtney, have you got some wild hope of recovering your wife's body?
I've even got a wild hope she may be alive. Lucy's a very strong swimmer.
You're acting like a nut, son.
Get set, everybody. I'm going to swing around.
We're in the current now. Better hold tight.
I've got to duck my own head when we go through. Everybody else, squat down.
I still protest against this. Don't you understand, Mr. Courtney?
Get ready. Here we go.
What on earth is wrong? There's no Blue Grotto. It's as black as pitch.
My dear Nellie, I kept trying to tell all of you. The blue grotto effect is caused by the sun's rays. There never is one except when the sun is out. Just how does our friend propose to find anything in here? Listen.
Something got hold of the side of the boat. I felt it move.
Not the dead girl, I trust.
There's a hand here.
A wet hand. Lucy.
She's not alive.
Mr. Granger, help me lift her up over the side. Easy, easy now. Don't tip the boat. Oh, Lucy. Lucy, are you all right?
No.
Are you all right, Lucy? Can you hear me?
All right. I'm just exhausted. I got in here. Couldn't swim out against the current.
Oh, don't try to talk.
I've got to talk. I'm going to faint. Tom, who's with you?
Only our friends.
Who's with you? Is the murderer with you?
I was just wondering the same thing. To be shut up in the dark at 3 o'clock in the morning with a criminal lunatic.
Oh, Ben.
Now, Lucy, don't hold me so tight. Let go, dear. I'll get the boat started and have you out of here in a second.
I spoke to him.
Only Dr. Davis.
Tom, I've got to tell you. I know how that girl, Josephine Adams, died. Almost killed me.
Has anybody here got some brandy? Or a flashlight?
I have a flashlight, my friend. Will you allow me, as a medical man, to examine Mrs. Courtney?
You better keep back for just a second, Doctor. She's hysterical. Give me the flashlight, please.
I walked into the other room. Nobody with me. All alone except Tiberius.
Yes, Lucy.
Somebody called my name. From the balcony, I thought. Very softly. Mrs. Courtney, said. Mrs. Courtney.
Did you recognize the voice?
Yes. That's why I went.
Hadn't you better start up this boat and get out of here,
Ben?
Don't pay any attention to them, Lucy. Nobody can hurt you now.
I went out on the balcony. The bright moonlight. Bright as day. But there was nobody there.
Nobody on the balcony?
No. I looked out over the sea. And then something came at me. Something flew out of the air and came at me.
Just one moment before Mrs. Courtney goes on. Is anybody in this boat carrying a revolver?
Not that I know of.
Excuse my mentioning it, but I felt something. Metal. Like a revolver. Brush past my hand.
Oh, it was only the flashlight.
Excuse me, it was not a flashlight. Mr. Courtney's got the flashlight.
Would you please let Lucy go on and finish? Lucy, you were on the balcony and something came at you.
Yes. Like a snake. Sideways. Out of the air. It went over my head. Fastened around my neck. It was a rope. With a running noose in it.
A rope?
That's it. A rope. It was thrown from another balcony. I'm small and light, like Josephine Adams. But it pulled me sideways. And over the rail. I fell.
I think I begin to understand what...
They couldn't see what happened to Josephine Adams. Frosted glass doors to the balcony. So they couldn't see.
But take it easy now. You're perfectly safe.
But is she perfectly safe?
The murderer let her fall on the rope. But the rope was jerked tight long before she struck the water. That broke her neck. Then the murderer lowered her softly.
So there wasn't any splash. And the current took her away, rope and all.
That's it. It would have happened to me. Only the rope must have slipped through the murderer's fingers.
Through whose fingers?
What did I tell you? Somebody in this boat has got a revolver.
Who's overboard? Somebody went?
Switch on that light, my friend, and shine it on the water.
All right, Doctor. There's your light. Look at it. Turning over and over. The water in the blue grotto is red now.
Tom, stay close to me.
Oh, it's all right, Lucy. I swear you're safe enough now.
Did he shoot himself?
Yes.
Did who shoot himself?
Who had a balcony exactly like ours on the house next door? Who began life as a cowpuncher and would have known how to use a lasso?
Yes, and knew Josephine Adams well and got it into his maniac's head that Mrs. Courtney was Josephine Adams all over again.
Harry Granger. Look. There's his 10-gallon hat floating away.
Thank you.
And so ends The Bride Vanishes, a story of mysterious doings in the Isle of Capri. And tonight's story of suspense.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
I know. Another break. What can I do to promise to come back soon? Next up, we have a show from MindWebs, which was a program of science fiction that ran on WHA Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, from 1976 to 1984. Now, these programs are actually a bit more like audiobooks than audio drama. Maybe really just sort of someplace in between. The show was produced, directed, and usually starred as the principal actor, Michael Hansen. And what he did was he took some of the very best short science fiction stories around, gave them a dramatic reading, often with multiple performers, taking the parts of various characters. These performances are rounded off with the addition of good atmospheric background music, usually composed by Mr. Hansen, who is still in the environs of Madison, Wisconsin, making his living as a jazz musician. Maybe I should say making his way as a jazz musician. I have no idea if he makes his living this way. This particular story is the adaptation of an early story by Harlan Ellison, where an alien is appointed by the gods to dispense pain briefly, inhabits a man, and discovers that without pain there is no contrast to show what happiness is. The earliest reference to the story that I can find is from the book Pain God and Other Delusions, which was a collection of short stories by Harlan Ellison, which was originally published in 1965 by Pyramid Books. If you don't know who Harlan Ellison is, I would recommend that if you have Netflix streaming or otherwise can get your hands on a copy of the documentary Dreams with Sharp Teeth, you should get it and watch it. It points out the strengths and weaknesses of this remarkable author, who is probably as well known for his prickly nature as he is the brilliance of his writings. It's often been said that if Harlan were not such a difficult man, he would be unquestionably regarded as one of the great literary figures of our times, right up there with Ray Bradbury. That's probably right. I met him once. He was nice to me. It was, I think about 1966, and I went to the World Science Fiction Convention for the first and last time and met him there. He does have this reputation for not suffering fools gladly, and I think that at 20, I probably pretty well fit the description of a fool. I think I probably still do. But he was nice to me. Maybe it's just because he knew he wasn't gonna have to put up with me for very long.
Welcome to a half hour through the friction.
Oblong head throbbed and his eye globes were dulling a little more each decade.
the interlinked duodenal ulcers so necessary to his endocrine system's normal function had begun to misfire like faulty plugs in an old car. The thwack of his salamander tail had grown weaker, indicating his motor responses to nerve endings were feebler. Trante, who had always been considered rather a handsome example of his race, had slowly come to look forlorn, weary, even a touch pathetic. And he sent down woe to an armored flying creature with a mite-sized brain on a dark planet at the edge of the coal sack. He dispatched fear and trembling to a smoke-like wraith that was the only visible remains of a great race that had learned to dispense with its body centuries before in the sun known as Rattel. He conscientiously winged terror and unhappiness and misery and sadness to a group of murdering pirates, a clique of shrewd politicians, and a brothel full of unregenerate whores, all on the fifth power planet of the White Horse constellation. Stopped alone there in the night of space, his mind spiraling now for the first time down a strange and disquieting chamber of thought, Trante twisted within himself. I was selected because I lacked the certain difficulties I now manifest. What is this torment? What is this unpleasant, unhappy, unrelenting feeling that gnaws at me, tears at me, corrupts my thoughts, colors darkly my every desire? Am I going mad? Madness is beyond my race. It is something we have never known. Have I been at this post too long? Have I failed in my duties? If there was a god stronger than the god that I am, or a god stronger than the Ethos gods, then I would appeal to that god. But there is only silence and the night and the stars, and I'm alone, so god all alone here, doing what I must, doing my best. And then finally, I must know. While he spun the fiber of melancholy down to a double thorax insect creature on the O, speared with dread a blob of barely sentient mud on Akaris 3, pain goaded into suicide in the electrical wave being capable of producing exquisite 15-toned harmonics on Sindon Beta 5, reduced by half the pleasures of a pitiable slug thing in the methane caves of Kirkharrow 4. Enshrouded in bitterness and misery, a man named Colin Marshak on an insignificant planet called Sol 3, Earth, Terra, the world. And then, finally, I will know. I will know. Trante removed the scaled model of Earth from the display crate and stared at it. Such a tiny thing, such a helpless thing to support the night walk of a pain god. He selected the most recent recipient of his attentions, through no more involved method than that, and used the means of travel his race had long since perfected to leave his encased cubicle hanging translucent against the stars. Trante, pain god of the universes, for the first time in all the centuries he had lived that life of giving, never receiving, left his place and left his now and went to find out. To find out what he had no way of knowing. For the pain god, it was the first night walk. Peter Kozlik had been born in the dwarf province of a minuscule central European country, long since swallowed up by a tiny power now a member of the common market. He had left Europe early in the 1920s, had shipped aboard a freighter to Bolivia, and after working his way as common deckhand and laborer through half a dozen banana republics, had been washed up on an inland shore of the United States in 1934. He had promptly gone to Earth, gone to seed, gone to fat. A short stint in the CCC camp, a shorter stint as a bouncer in a Kansas City speak, a term in the Illinois State Workhouse. A long run on the Pontiac assembly line, making an obscure part for an obscure segment of B-17's innards. A brief fling as owner of a raspberry farm, and an extended period as a skid row frequenting Wino summed up his life. Now, as now would be reckoned by any sane man's ephemeris, Peter Koslick was a wet brain, an alcoholic so sunk in the fumes and vapors of his own liquor need that he was barely recognizable as a human being. Lying soddenly but quietly in an alley two blocks up from the Greyhound bus station in downtown Los Angeles, Peter Koslick, age 59, weight 210, hair filth gray, eyes red and moist and closed, unceremoniously died. That simply, that unconcernedly, that uneventfully for all the young old men in overlong GI surplus overcoats who passed by that alley mouth unseeing, uncaring. Peter Koslick died. His brain gave out. His lungs ceased to bellow. His heart refused to pump. His blood slid to a halt in his veins, and breath no longer passed his lips. He died. End of story. Beginning of story. As he lay there, half propped against the brick wall with its shredded reminder of a lightweight boxing match between two stumble bums long since passed into obscurity in the files of Ring magazine, a tepid, thin vapor of pale green came to the useless body of Peter Koslick, touched it, felt of it, entered it. Tronte was on the planet Earth, Sol 3. If it had been possible to mount an epitaph on bronze with a wet brain there on the wall of the alley, perhaps the most fitting would have been, "Here lay Peter Koslick. Nothing in his life became him so much as the leaving of it." Cullen Marshak, walking the streets, did not even realize the rheumy-eyed old man was following him. Then he turned, and the old man almost ran into him. "There's something I can do for you?" Cullen Marshak asked. The old man grinned feebly, his pale gums exposing themselves above gap-toothed ruin.
No, sir. I was just following along to see maybe I could tap you for a couple cents to get some chicken noodle soup. It's kind of cold, and I thought maybe I..."
Colin Marshak's wide, somehow humorous face settled into understanding lines. "You're right, old man. It's cold, and it's windy, and it's miserable, and I think you're entitled to some goddamn chicken noodle soup. God knows someone's entitled." He paused a beat and added, "Maybe me." He took the old man by the arm, seemingly unaware of the rancid, rotting condition of the cloth. They walked along the street outside the park and turned into one of the many side routes littered with one-armed beanries and 40-cents-a-night flop houses. "And possibly a hot roast beef sandwich with gravy all over the French fries," Cullen added, stirring the wine-smelling old derelict into a restaurant. Over coffee and a bear claw, Colin Marshak stared at the old man.
"Hey, what's your name?" "Peter Koslick,"
the old man remembered the hot vapors from the thick white coffee mug rising up before his watery eyes.
I've been, you know, kind of sick."
"Too much sauce, old man," said Colin Marshak. "Too much sauce does it for a lot of us. My father and mother both. Nice folk, loved each other. They went to the old Elkies home hand in hand. It was touching."
"You're kind of feeling sorry for yourself, ain't you?"
said Peter Koslick and looked down at his coffee hurriedly. Colin stared across angrily. Had he sunk that low, that quickly, that even the seediest cockroach-ridden bum in the gutter could snap at him, talk up to him, see his sad and sorry state? He tried to lift his coffee cup, and the cream-laced liquid sloshed over the rim over his wrist. He yipped and set the cup down quickly.
"Your hands shake worse than mine do, mister,"
Peter Koslick noted. It was a curious tone, somehow devoid of feeling or concern, more a statement of observation.
"Yeah, my hands shake, Mr. Koslick, sir. They shake because I make my living cutting things out of stone, and for the past 2 years I've been unable to get anything from stone but tidy piles of rock dust."
Koslick spoke around a mouthful of color.
You're one of them statue makers? What I mean, a sculptor? That is precisely what I am, Mr. Koslick, sir. I'm a capture of exquisite beauty in rock and plaster and quartz and marble. The only trouble is I'm no damned good, and I was never ever really very good, but at least I made a decent living selling the piece here and there, and conning myself into thinking I was great and building a career. In Canada, in the Times said a few nice things about me once, but even that's turned to rust now. I can't make a chisel do what I want it to do. I can't sand, and I can't chip, and I can't carve dirty words on sidewalks if I try. Peter Koslick stared across at Colin Marshack, and there was a bank fire down in those roomy, sad old eyes. He watched and looked and saw the hands shaking uncontrollably, saw them ring one against another like mad things, and even when interlocked, they still trembled hideously. And Tronte, locked within an alien shell, comprehended a small something. This creature of puny carbon atoms and other substances that could not exist for an instant in the rigorous arena of space was dying. Inside, it was ending its life cycle because of the misery Tronte had sent down. Tronte had been responsible for the quivering pain that sent Colin Marshak's hand into spasms. It had been done 2 years before, by Colin Marshak's time, but only a few moments earlier, as Tronte knew it. And now it had changed this creature's life totally. Tronte watched the strange human being, a product of little introverted needs and desires. And he knew he must go further, must experiment further with his problem. The green and transparent vapor that was Tronte seeped out of the eyes of Peter Koslick and slid carefully inside Colin Marshak. It left itself wide open, flung itself wide open to what tremors govern the man. And Tronte felt the full impact of the pain he so lightly dispensed to all the living things in the universes. It was a potent, hot awe. And it was a further knowing, a greater knowledge, a simple act that the sickness had compelled him to undertake. By the fear and the memory of all the fears that had gone before, Tronte knew. And knowing had to go further, for he was pain god, not a transient tourist in the country of pain. He drew forth the mind of Marshak, of that weak and trembling Colin Marshak, and fled with it. Out. Out there. Further. Much further. Till time came to a slithering halt and space was no longer of any consequence. And he whirled Colin Marshak through the universes, through the infinite allness of the space and time and motion and meaning that was the crevice into which life had sunk itself. He saw the blobs of mud and the whirling winged things and the tall humanoids and the cleat-treaded half-man, half-machines that ruled one in another sector of open space. He showed it all to Colin Marshak, drenched him in wonder, filled him like the most vital goblet the ethos had ever created, poured him full of love and life and the staggering beauty of the cosmos. And having done that, he whirled the soul and spirit of Colin Marshak down, down, and down to the fiber shell that was his body, and poured that soul back inside. Then he walked the shell to the home of Colin Marshak and turned it loose. When the sculptor awoke, lying face down amidst the marble chips and powder fine dust of the statue, he saw the base first, and not having recalled even buying a chunk of stone that large, raised himself on his hands and his knees and his haunches and sat there. His eyes went up toward the summit and seemed to go on forever. And when he finally saw what it was he had created, this thing of such incredible loveliness and meaning and wisdom, he began to sob. Softly, never very loud, but deeply, as though each whimper was drawn from the very core of him. He had done it this once. But as he saw his hands still trembling, still murmuring to themselves in spasms, he knew it was the one time he would ever do it. There was no memory of how of why or even of when. But it was his work. Of that he was certain. The pain in his wrists told him it was. The moment of truth stood high above him, resplendent in marble. But there would be no other moments. This was Colin Marshak's life in its totality now. The sound of sobbing was only broken periodically as he began to drink. Waiting. The ethos waited. Conte had known they would be. It was inevitable. Foolish for him to conceive of a situation of which they would not have an awareness. Away from your post. Away. I had to know. It has been growing in me, a live thing in me. I had to know. It was the only way. I went to a planet and lived within what they call men and knew. I think I understand now. No. What is it you know? I know that pain is the most important thing in the universes. Greater than survival. Greater than love. Greater even than the beauty it brings about. For without pain, there can be no pleasure. Without sadness, there can be no happiness. Without misery, there can be no beauty. And without these, life is endless, hopeless, doomed, and damned. Adult. You have become adult. I know. This is what became of the other pain gods before me. They grew into concern, into knowing, and then lost. They were lost to us. They could not take the step. They could not go to one of the ones to whom they had sent pain and learn. So they were no use as pain god. I understand. Now I know. And I am returned. Do. What will you do? I will send more pain than ever before. More and greater. More. You will send more. Much more. Because now I understand. It's a gray and lonely place in which we live, all of us, swinging between desperation and emptiness. And all that makes it worthwhile is caring, is beauty. But if there were no opposite for beauty or for pleasure, it would all turn to dust. Being. Now you know who you are. I am most blessed of the ethos and most humble. You have given me the highest, kindest position in the universes. For I am the god to all men. And to all creatures, small and large, whether they call me by name or not, I am Pain God. And it is my life, however long it stretches, to treat them to the finest they may ever know, to give them pain that they may know pleasure. Thank you. And the ethos went away, secure that at last, after all the eons of pain gods who had broken under the strain, who had lacked the courage to take that night walk, they had found one who would last truly forever. Tronte had come of age. While back in the cubicle, hanging star bright and translucent in space high above it all, yet very much part of it all, the creature who would never die, the creature who had lived within the rotting body of Pieter Koslick, and for a few fleet moments in the soul and talent of Colin Marshak, that creature called Pain God learned one more thing as he stared at the tiny model of the planet Earth he had known. Tronte knew the feel of a tear formed in a duct and turned free from an eye globe and cooled on his face.
Tronte, new happiness. You've heard the story, Pain God. It comes from the Pyramid Book, titled Pain God and Other Delusions, by Harlan Ellison. I am Michael Hansen. Technical operation for this program by Phil Corvo. Mind Webs is a production of WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.
Lend Uncle Sam a dime to win this war, and he'll pay you back with interest when he's won it. The easiest, most convenient way to lend him these dimes is to enroll in the payroll savings plan. Just tell your boss to deduct 10 cents from every dollar he pays you and lend it to Uncle Sam in your name. Sign up for this simple savings plan today, and when victory comes, you'll have war bonds in your pockets instead of Axis bonds on your wrists.
Finally, we have a episode of The Whistler, which began its run on May the 16th of 1942. Originally, it was a West Coast-only show due to the fact that the original sponsor, Signal Oil, was only available on the West Coast and saw no point in spending good money to have this program broadcast where its products were not available. Tonight, we actually have the audition program for The Whistler, which was broadcast on May the 16th of 1942. It's about a man, John Hendricks, who killed both his wife and his feeble-minded stepson with an axe while trying to steal their money. And John has, as the story unfolds, escaped jail. He returns to the house where he hid the money. And I guess, not unpredictably, weird stuff happens.
Wait a minute. Have you heard The Whistler?
Money is not enough. We want you, John. We want you.
That was his wife, Martha, the former widow Martha.
Yes, Mother. Yes.
And her simple-minded son, Henry.
Go ahead, son. Go ahead. We must have John Henry. Yes, Mother. Yes, Mother.
Tonight, CBS presents a new mystery series, The Whistler.
And I, the Whistler, know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales, many secrets hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak. And so I tell you tonight the strange story of Retribution. Gaze up this muddy, rain-splattered road. Small, lonely stone building appears against the lightning-streaked sky. The dismal courthouse of a southern village. The village of Marsdenburg. It is nearly midnight. A trial is in progress. A murder trial. John Hendricks is on trial for his life. The state versus Henry killed his wife and stepson. He killed his wife and her simple-minded son, Henry, for the $10,000 in cash she kept in her big house on the outskirts of town. Open the door. There he stands. John Hendricks, a huge, silent man of 50, large, bony hands. Close the door. Well, what do you think? Does he look like a murderer? The prosecutor is closing his argument.
Yes, yes, listen. It has been proven that Mrs. Hendricks had no current bank account. It has been proven that she did have a large sum of money which she kept on her estate. John Hendricks knew of his money and attempted to steal it, was caught in the act and killed them both in order to cover up the theft. It was not a tramp who killed that old gray-haired lady and her simple son. There was only one intruder, one thief, one murderer. And there he sits, ladies and gentlemen. There he sits in all his guilt. A vicious killer. A murderer. There is only one decision for you to make. There is only one penalty that can erase from this countryside the stigma of this fiendish crime. One penalty for this axe-murderer, John Hendricks. And that penalty is death. Take rest.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict? Have you reached a verdict?
Your Honor, we the jury, due to lack of more complete evidence, find the defendant guilty of murder in the second degree.
Second degree. Cheated death. He'll get life. Surprise. Of course you are. But it had to be. It had to be. I know.
John Hendricks, stand up.
Yes, John, stand up. Face the court. Watch him now. He's on the street.
John Hendricks, I wish to state that I am not in accord with the findings of this jury. However, there's nothing for me to do but sentence you to the state penitentiary for the remainder of your natural life.
Know where you are now? Recognize that huge, sprawling stone structure with the high walls around it? State Penitentiary. How much later? 10 years. John Hendricks is in there. He has a number now. 1013. Let's go through the gates. Up the steps. Down the corridor. Here we are in cell block 2. Night again. Just turn in. This has been going on for 10 years for John Hendricks, 1013, and his cellmate Bill, 1014. Bill, 1014, is a gangster. Or rather, he was. But he's changed during the 5 years he's been here. Bill has decided to go straight if he ever gets out, which is very doubtful. But he holds no resentment, has become more or less happy. Bill started reading here, philosophy and so forth. He's changed. But what about John Hendricks? Oh, no. Not Hendricks. Because he has a plan. He has a purpose. Move close to the cell door and listen.
All I got to say, Bill, is I think you're crazy enough to make the try with you.
That's a matter of opinion, John.
But it'll be simple. I got everything all set. It's all fixed. Not a chance of a slip up.
All fixed? Who will?
Well, a friend of mine.
Oh, I see. Crooked guard.
No, he ain't a guard.
Don't tell me you got a fix with a warden.
What difference does it make who it is so long as the whole thing is set and fixed?
Well, you've got to have some help, inside or out. Oh, idiot. I think you're nuts. Stir crazy.
I'm getting out of this place. I got a reason, a good reason. I got something waiting for me outside. Something I can enjoy. Something that belongs to me. I'm the only one that knows where it is, and I'm going out. You're in here for a good long time, but then if you don't want to go with me, you can stay and rot.
Look, Hendricks, I still think you're nuts.
All right, what of it?
I got the right dope, ain't I?
And it'll work.
Suppose it does. Suppose you find this money hidden away on the old lady's estate. What good do you? You killed her and her son together.
That's a lie. I didn't. I didn't kill anybody.
I say you did.
Ain't true, not a word of it. But I know where the money is.
Okay, you can break out. You can have the money, but... Well, I've done a lot of reading since I've been here.
Ah, you've done
so. Maybe so. But I know this much now. If I ever do get out, I'll do things a lot different. Believe me, Hendricks, I'll tread the straight and narrow. I've done a lot of things that I'm sure sorry for now. I can't undo them. But I won't do them again. No, sir, I'll do things different. Not the way I did it before.
Ah, you're just a religion, but it won't get you out.
Maybe not, but I'm resigned. I got exactly what's coming, I mean. And believe me, Hendricks, so will you. So will you. If you break out, they'll have you back one way or another. You watch and see.
Well, I'm going, so you watch and see. Watch and see.
Now, another storm. Another night. A lonely country road. A car.
We're in the south. That village we passed a few miles back, that silent, sleeping village, was Marsdenburg. Yes, Marsdenburg, remember? That small, lonely stone building was the courthouse. The courthouse where John Hendricks was tried and convicted. We're on the outskirts now, on a lonely road. A young man is driving the old car, and there's a girl beside him. Motor trouble? Well, there, just ahead of light. Yes, it's a little crossroads store. Pull in.
There's a light, but I don't see anybody. Oh, it's closed. We better drive on.
I guess you're right.
Now, evening, folks. What's your trouble?
We're having motor trouble.
Oh, is it? How are you doing here, driving around on a night like this?
On our way west. Mister, is there an inn or something around here where we can stay for the night?
An inn? Yes, there's a place about 8 miles up the road. They'll probably put you up. There's a sign on the left-hand side of the road. Can't miss it. This road's pretty bad when it rains. Gotta be careful or you'll find yourself walking.
Thanks. We'll try. Good night.
Good luck, mister.
You'll need the luck.
Muddy road sparkles in the flashes of lightning. The tall, dark trees sway back and forth in the fury of the storm like moaning lost souls. The little car lurches and bounces in its white heat center of the highway. 2 miles, 3 miles, four, maybe five, and look, there it is, straight ahead. On the right side of the road, a blue light. Ah, yes, that's it. Wait, Jordan. Did the old man say on the right side or the left side of the road?
George, what's wrong?
I don't know. The distributor must have gotten wet.
Look, George.
What?
That blue light we saw, it's gone. Where is it?
It must have passed it.
But we couldn't have. I was looking right at it. It seemed as though it just disappeared in the thin air.
I'd better turn in here. This motor won't last much longer.
Yes, sir.
I can't see a thing.
No,
I... Can you?
Certainly desolate looking place. There must be a house back in there. There it is. Look, there's a driveway. 20 feet ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, this motor's about to conk out. So we'd better drive in and see what we can find.
Yes. Drive in, George. You'll find something. That's right. Through the gate. Make the curve. All right. There goes your motor. A little more. Now.
Oh, we just made it. Thank heaven.
Yes, that's right. Always thank heaven at a time like this. All right. Get out and go up on the porch.
Well, let me help you.
I'm all right. What do we do with the bags?
We'll leave them here in the car till we find out if there's anyone here. Come on.
You see a bell?
No. I don't see a thing. Gee, this place looks completely deserted. I don't think anyone lives here.
I don't either. Let's go. George, let's don't knock. I don't like this place. Let's go on.
How, with a dead motor? Where could we go? I'll knock.
Well, all right.
Ah, that's right. Knock, George. Knock. Go ahead. Louder. Again. We've got to have shelter.
Yes, we can't stay in that car any longer. Can we?
No. Why not?
Here it comes. Now you're on your own, George. On your own.
There is someone.
Yes?
Oh!
Good evening.
What is it?
Well, our car...
Our car stalled.
And we can't go any farther, and it's such a terrible night out that we thought we could stop here for the evening.
stop here?
Why, yes, we saw your light and...
Light? What light?
Why, the little neon out front.
There is no light.
Well, have you a room?
Yes, there is a room.
Well, could we come in? I mean, it's awfully wet out here.
You may come in if you wish.
Oh, thank you.
Well, this is quite a relief. We were afraid you'd close up for the night, especially when all the lights were out.
Are the lights out?
Yes, you see. Huh?
Of course the lights are out.
Oh, I didn't know.
You do take tours.
Do we?
Oh, yes, that's what they told us.
Who told you?
Well, the man. The old man at the little store back at the crossroads.
Little store?
Yes. At the crossroad about 5 miles back. You know where the crossroad is, don't you?
There is no store at the crossroads.
There isn't?
No.
I see. Look, madam, would you mind turning on the lights? I can't see a thing.
We have no lights here.
No lights?
Give me a flashlight. She means there's no electricity.
No. There is no light here.
Oh, throw the flash around. There must be a lamp.
No. Don't make a light. We see well in the dark.
We? Who's we? Is there someone else in the house?
My son.
Oh, he's going to bed?
No. He is standing beside you.
Beside who?
You. Huh?
Yes, Mother.
Oh!
Gee, give me the flashlight.
Got it. You got it.
Oh, yeah. How long have you been standing there, Bob?
Since you came in.
That's all I can see. You make a noise like a spook.
Who are you? What is your name?
George Kimball. This is my wife, Jill. We're on our way west with travelers.
Travelers? So are we.
What?
Quiet, son. Quiet.
No, let him talk. He's quiet.
How long have you both been living here?
We lived here all our lives.
Sam, how about closing the door?
Is the door open?
Why, of course it's open. What?
George!
Now, take it easy, Joan. Don't get excited. Oh, look, madam, there's a candle on that table up at the fireplace.
Is there?
Yes, and if you don't mind, I'm going to light it.
Please don't.
Oh, wait a minute. If you want us to stay here, we insist that we have some light. You want us to stay here, don't you?
Do we, son? Yes, mother.
What are you looking at me
for? Yes, mother. Without light. Yes, Mother.
George, let's go. I don't want to stay here tonight. This place doesn't look good to me.
There has been no good here for many years.
See what I mean, George?
I don't get it. You don't seem to want us, yet your son does. How do you make any money that way?
We don't make money.
You don't? You mean you haven't had any guests lately?
No, not for many years.
Well, you can't expect any of like this.
But we do expect a guest, don't we, sir?
Yes, Mother.
Well, he certainly has a surprise coming.
Yes, he has.
How many rooms have you?
There are many rooms, but only one.
Only one? That doesn't make sense. What do you mean?
Only one for guests.
You mean only one equipped?
Yes.
Well, then if you've got it reserved for this guest you expect, what are we going to do?
There is an inn farther along the road. They have rooms. They will take care of you. It will be best for us.
Our distributor got wet, so our car won't run.
Where is your car?
Right there at the foot of the steps.
I see no car.
You don't? Why, it's standing right...
George! George, where is it? It's gone!
Holy smoke, it is gone. Where? How? I didn't hear a sound. It must have rolled ahead. Well,
throw your light around.
Not a sign of it. Say, what goes on here?
Son.
Yes, Mother.
You move the car.
Yes, Mother.
I understand. I understand.
Wait a minute. Your son moved it? How could he? The motor won't even run. And even if it would, we didn't hear a sound.
No sound.
How did you move it?
I don't know.
Well, that's a fun thing. Here we are in a place where they don't want us and no way of leaving. Well, you've got us on your hands now. You'll have to make the best of it.
No, George, no. We'll leave.
Nonsense. This is all silly. Come on, let's have some light and cut out the monkey business.
Wait. Son, what have we decided?
Yes, Mother. We decided yes.
Very well. If you wish, you may stay. stay until...
Until when?
All night. Yes, Mother.
If you wish.
Oh, that's better. That's more like it. Now I'll light this candle. There we are.
George, look.
Well, Molly, look at the dust in the cobwebs. This looks deserted, like an old cellar. Well, how about the room? Do we get it, or are the guests you're expecting?
There is another room that will do, perhaps.
Well, could we see?
Yes. And by the way, how much do you charge?
We charge nothing.
You charge nothing?
Nothing.
Sounds silly, but it's right for us. We're running short, anyway. Well, let's see the room.
Very well. It is upstairs.
After you, ma'am.
No. You go first.
Very well. Come on, Bill. Bring that other candle.
Come, sir. Follow me.
Yes, Mother.
I never saw so much dust.
Well, they must like it. You know, nice clean dust.
That room at the head of the stairs.
Why? This room is well furnished. Is this the room reserved for your expected guest?
No.
But you said you had only one room furnished. Who sleeps here?
I stay here now.
I see. Or do I?
It's a nice top there.
It was always comfortable. We'll leave you now. Come, son. We must leave them alone now.
Yes, Mother. Leave them alone.
Good night.
Good night.
You will lock your door?
Huh? Oh, yes, yes. We'll lock it.
Goodbye.
Say, did she say good night or goodbye?
I don't know. I thought she said... She did say goodbye.
Golly, what a screwy outfit. I wish we hadn't had car trouble. That's what we get for trying to drive in the storm.
How much money have we left?
Not much. Just enough to get to Los Angeles the way I figure. Once I get there, I know there'll be a job for me. We'll make it, don't worry. You'll see me in a nice job in Hollywood.
I'm not worried about seeing you in Hollywood.
No?
No. I'm just worried about seeing you in the morning.
The same night, but later. It's midnight. Another car on the same road. You know who it is. It's John Hendricks. You know where he's going. He turns in at our deserted mansion, up the driveway, and stops. He steps out. Slips up the steps, opens the door, and throws his flash about the dusty room. Cobwebs glisten in the beam. A few moments, and the light comes to rest on the fireplace. He steps quickly to the mantel, draws a small hammer and chisel from his pocket, and sets to work removing a brick. Ah, now he's finished. The brick is loose. He reaches in and withdraws a heavy yellow envelope. He starts to put it in his pocket, but suddenly freezes in his tracks. He can't move. He turns icy cold. Turn around, Hendricks. Turn around. Look. At the foot of the stairs, across the room, stands a woman holding a candle, and beside her, a grinning youth holding an axe. Turn around, Hendricks. Look at their heads, covered with blood. Turn around.
John Hendricks, murderer.
John Hendricks, thief.
What?
Yes, John.
Henry.
Yes, John.
No.
We come for you, John, the same way you came for us. We've been waiting for you, John. We knew you'd come back for the money. We've been waiting. We've come to take you, John.
No. Please don't come near me. Please.
You must suffer, John, as we have suffered.
I've suffered.
Not enough, John. Not enough.
I didn't mean to do it. I didn't plan to kill you. I went mad, lost my head. No. Don't come near me. You can have the money. You can have it.
Then give it to us, John. Give us the money. You won't need it now. Come, son. We must have the money, and we must take John. Come, son. Come.
No. There's the money on the floor.
Money is not enough, John. Money is not enough. Go ahead, son. Go ahead. We must have John Hendricks, thief, murderer.
Yes, mother. No.
Bullets won't stop us.
Good Lord, George. What was that?
I heard a scream. Downstairs.
What did I? and Doc.
I'll open the door. It must have been downstairs. I don't see a thing.
Here's your flashlight.
Great Scott. Look. A man down there on the floor. Come on. He's dead.
Look at the gun.
It's been fired. But I don't see a mark on him.
Let's get out of here.
I'll say, come on.
Hurry up. Stand for your...
George!
Cops!
What's going on here? Hand over that gun. Thanks. What are you doing here?
Well, we're stopping here. That is, we're just leaving.
I can see that. Know this man on the floor?
Know him? Yes.
Joan, what's the matter with you?
No, we don't.
Take a look, Frank. Yes, sir? What are you two doing here?
Why, we're guests.
Yes, we're both guests.
Guests? Who's guests?
Why, guests. Lodgers. Tourists. Guests of the old lady.
What old lady?
The old lady that lives here. The old lady and her son.
I'd have to cook up a better one than that.
What do you mean?
Drive here? Where's your car?
The son took it.
Son, old lady, what are you talking about?
They live here. They said they owned this place. We had motor trouble, and they put us up for the night.
What about him, Frank?
Well, he isn't dead, breathing. Looks like he had a stroke or something.
It's him, all right. John Hendricks.
Take a look around. See if there's anyone else here.
Yes, sir.
What's your name?
George Kimball. This is my wife. We're on our way to California. Do you know who this man is?
Certainly. We've been on his trail. He's an escaped convict. This your gun?
No, sir.
Did he shoot at you?
No, sir.
You shoot at him? This gun's been fired, and we heard shots as we turned in the driveway.
Out of sight of anyone, sir. Nothing but dust and cobwebs.
Look, Campbell. You said there was an old lady and her son here.
Sure. They were here all evening.
And out here now.
Well, they let us in and showed us to our room. They certainly were here.
What did the old lady look like?
Well, she had gray hair, wore a house dress and an apron.
What did the boy look like?
He was a big kid, about 20. Had a round, rosy face, and I think, I know he was kind of simple-minded. He had a strange laugh, and he had red hair.
Well, I'll be darned. What do you think of that, Frank?
Golly, isn't it the creeps?
Why so?
You know who you've just described?
No.
The old lady and her son who used to live here.
Used to live here?
Yeah. They were murdered here 10 years ago.
What?
Murder? Sure. This man on the floor was her husband, the boy's stepfather. He was tried for killing them with an axe and stealing her money and bonds. He got off at second degree because of lack of evidence. He escaped a week ago and headed this way. He's been on his trail ever since he entered this county. So you see, Kimball, if there was anybody else here tonight, it must have been a figment of your imagination. This house has been deserted for 10 years.
Oh, George.
Good Lord.
Look, Sergeant. Found this envelope on the back doorstep. It's the money.
Well, what do you know? The money and the bond. Old Martha. Hendricks' money. That's why Hendricks came here.
But where did they go? The old lady?
No place. Because they weren't here, Kimball. Well, better get them out of here and back to headquarters.
Now, wait a minute. Don't leave us.
We won't. You're coming along, too.
Why?
We need you for a day or two. All right, let's get going, Frank. Come on.
But where did they go? We saw them. I know they were here.
Well, you certainly described them to a T, but don't worry too much about it, you know. Things like this can drive you nuts. You know what I mean? Things like this sometimes just happen. You know what I mean?
No.
Well, oh, come on, let's go before I get the heebie-jeebies.
What did he say? Things like this just sometimes happen? Just happen? Well, sometimes they do and can't be explained. But not this time. Oh, no, not this time. This can be explained. Remember John Hendricks' cellmate, Bill? Bill number 1014? He can explain. He knows all about it, because he planned it. Bill wanted the money. He'd learned all the dope from Hendricks. He sent his pals, the phony spooks, made up like the old lady and her son, to grab the money when Hendricks recovered it. Too bad they dropped it in their hurry to get away. Bill didn't want to hurt John. He wanted to scare him out of it. Remember? Bill 1014 had changed. He said he'd never do things the way he'd done them before. And he didn't. Bill meant what he said.